By October 1961, Galen and General Lankow, who was in charge of Pulak's security group, had a series of secret conferences.
Galen had received the description of the mysterious Paul, who, Meinl had stated, was the Soviet double agent at BND headquarters. Galen had little doubt that the description fitted one of his most trusted men, higher government counselor Heinz Paul Johann Felfe, F-E-L-F-E, head of the counter-espionage department and recipient of the silver plaque for loyal service. It seems that Galen refused to believe this at first. If it were true, this would be the most painful blow he had suffered in his long career as a spymaster. He had always prided himself on being a good judge of men, and he could hardly bring himself to accept that he had been so disastrously deceived by Felfe over a period of many years. He realized that if Felfe were a traitor, and this became public knowledge, his own reputation would be irretrievably ruined. Yet he had to apprehend the traitor. He ordered Lankow to arrange for Felfe to be kept under round-the-clock surveillance. Whilst Lankow's security men were trailing Felfe, intercepting his mail, and watching his country house, another event took place that finally sealed his fate. On July 13th, about a month after Meinl's defection, and before Galen had received the description of Paul from CIA, a man and a woman came to the office of the West Berlin CID. The man produced papers in the name of Josef Lehmann and said the woman was his wife Inga, née Pohl, whom he had married in East Berlin a year before. He also asserted that his real name was Bogdan Stashinsky. And that's a name that's going to come up several times. So Bogdan Stashinsky is the man, the claimed real name of this man who showed up at the West Berlin CID. And that he was a Ukrainian, born in 1931 in a village near Lvov. Since 1951, he had been an agent of the KGB, and in 1955, he had infiltrated the Ukrainian anti-communist OUN in West Berlin. After all this had been taken down by the policeman, Lehmann Stashinsky made a startling deposition. He said that on October 10, 1957, he had killed Lev Rebet, one of the Ukrainian leaders in the entrance to the offices of the newspaper Ukrainsky Samostnik in Munich, by firing from a gas pistol a phial containing 5 cubic centimeters of hydrocyanic acid into Rebet's face. He then calmly added that 2 years later, October 15, 1959, he had murdered the leader of OUN, Stefan Bandera, in exactly the same manner. His KGB superiors had ordered him to return to Moscow from East Berlin, but he was afraid that he would have to carry out yet more of such assignments and had decided to give himself up. The German policemen who listened to this fantastic story believed not one word of it. They realized that the man was an East European, probably a Ukrainian, and that his papers in the name of Lehmann were false. They knew of the sudden deaths of Rebet and Bandera in Munich, but in both cases investigations had resulted in a verdict of death by natural causes, though under strange circumstances. Rebet had been found lifeless in the entrance hall of his office in Munich's Karlsplatz, still clutching an attaché case. The doctors stated that he had died of heart failure. Bandera, the Ukrainian leader who had worked for the British SIS, then during the war for the Nazis, and afterwards again for the British Secret Service and CIA in Germany, was found dead in front of the door of his apartment in Zeppelinstrasse in Munich. In his case, protracted investigations were carried out, since it was accepted that he might have been murdered, but no injury of any kind was found, nor was poisoning established, and the pathologist pronounced death from natural causes, namely heart failure. Stashinsky demanded to be handed over to American intelligence, and the German police chiefs gladly obliged. Investigations were conducted for several weeks by American CIC and Special Investigation Branch officers who distrusted Stashinsky's incredible confession and suspected him of being a Soviet agent provocateur, or provoking agent. Eventually, he was handed over to the German police, and BFV officers began to check his descriptions of his movements in 1957 and 1959. They found them to be accurate. Stashinsky also produced various documents, including a diploma of the award of the Order of the Red Banner, which he said he had been given for the murder of Bandera. Entries in his handwriting were found in the register of the Hotel Stachus in Munich, where he had stayed before killing Lev Rebet, and he produced a broken key the wrenched part of which was found still embedded in the lock of the door of Bandera's apartment. He gave the investigators a description of the murder weapons, which catapulted glass vials filled with cyanic acid. He told them how he had swallowed anti-poison capsules given him in Moscow in order to immunize the effect of the deadly vapor by which his victims were killed. Experts confirmed that hydrocyanic acid could cause immediate death if squirted at the victim's mouth and nostrils, and that after paralyzing the heart, it would leave no trace. The investigations were conducted with the greatest secrecy, and no announcement of Stashinsky's arrest and confessions was made. Early in October, however, a BFV official telephoned Felfa at Pulak, informing him of the amazing case and asking for his advice on some aspects of the prisoner's statements about KGB officials in Moscow who, Stashinsky said, had given him instructions and the murder weapons. Felfa immediately informed the Karlshorst KGB office of Stashinsky's arrest and the progress of the investigations in Munich and Bonn. The Russians began preparations for a propaganda counteroffensive. On October 13th, 2 days after the Federal Ministry of the Interior issued the first official announcement about the strange murders to which Stashinsky had confessed, the press officer of Prime Minister Grotewohl called a press conference in East Berlin, to which West Berlin journalists and correspondents of American, British, and other foreign newspapers were invited. Now, before I read this part, let me just mention, it's hard to keep an open mind in these things because Cookridge himself is a real admirer of Reinhard Gehlen, and he uses words like the Soviets began a propaganda blitz. Now, this is not to say that it might not have been just that, but the fact that basically throughout this book, the operations of Gehlen and his people, most of them ex-Nazis and completely unabashed ex-Nazis, are viewed through the through rose-colored glasses, and the KGB and the Soviet Union is viewed through the eyes of somebody who regards them as an implacable and dangerous enemy at all times. So, again, you have to bear that particular focus in mind. However, it does make the book even more useful because nobody can accuse Cookridge of being a knee-jerk liberal or a leftist pansy or anything like that.
Now, a couple of notes here, referring back to information carried in past archive shows. Now, we looked at a key Gehlen agent named Theodor Oberlander in our last Wackel show, and we also looked at his link-ups with Bunker Hunt. Now, Bunker Hunt of the John Birch Society, Bunker Hunt involved with the Kennedy assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. And one of the things that Bunker Hunt was involved with in turn was a group which he was going to name the American Volunteer Group, which, interestingly enough, was also the name of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in Japan, John Birch having been the intelligence advisor to Chennault at one point. And what Bunker Hunt was proposing, and we read some material from a book called Spooks by James Hogan, was setting up, basically, assassination squads in the United States. The aforementioned American Volunteer Group was to be the name, recruited from General Edwin Walker's John Birch Society cell in Dallas. Now, of course, we looked at Walker's links with Nazis both in this country and in Germany in our Radio Free America series number 11. Walker, a former nationalist Chinese military advisor, okay, going back to the China lobby, the MacArthur Group, and so forth, again from Aryan nations. Now, the murder weapon, which was going to be used by the American volunteer groups, was described as a gas gun developed in Germany, which would leave the victims, its victims, having a look like they had apparently died of heart attacks, and it would squirt hydrocyanic acid at the victims. The murder weapon sounding very, very much like what this Bogdan Stashinsky says he used on Bandera, and which may have been used on Bandera. The question is, who used it? And, of course, remember the Gehlen, Oberlander, Wackel, ABN, Bunker Hunt link. Bunker Hunt connected with Oberlander in a group called the Committee for the Preservation of Christian Culture. The Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, CDCC.
Okay, continuing on with the press conference. At the conference, a former Gehlen agent, Stefan Lippholz, was produced. He was a German, he said, born in 1907 at Staraya Alexandrovska in Volnia in Russia. Volhynia in Russia. In 1939, he had come to Germany, where he fought in Hitler's army and, because of his knowledge of the Russian language, was eventually posted to Schellenberg's Militaramt and became a liaison officer to the Vlasov Army. The Vlasov Army was a white Russian army fighting on the side of the Germans, which itself later became involved in a series of spy scandals.
And Gehlen and Oberlander, key people with the Vlasov Army, also the NTS, as we're about to see. Walter Schellenberg was head of the Sicherheitsdienst Overseas Intelligence Branch, the Sicherheitsdienst being the SS Intelligence Service.
After the war, Lippholz lived for a time in East Germany, then went to West Berlin and eventually joined the Galen organization, where he was ordered to recruit Ukrainians and Bielorussians for training as parachutists to be infiltrated into the Soviet Union. Remember, Stefan Bandera and his group were Ukrainian. He told at length of his work for the Org and how he became the landlord of the Stephansklause Inn in Munich, one of Galen's many fronts, and the meeting place of the Org's agents and V-men. His superiors at Pulak were Roman Henlinger, formerly with Himmler's RSHA, and Yaroslav Sulima, a Ukrainian who was in charge of training the parachutists. Lippholz stated that Galen had watched Bandera's activities on behalf of the British Secret Intelligence Service with misgivings. In 1956, Bandera and two of his aides, Voskovich and Benzal, were training Ukrainian agents whom the British intended to infiltrate into the Soviet Union by the way of Austria. Galen, according to Lippholz, wanted to foil the British plans, for he regarded them as dangerous competition to his own activities for CIA. Lippholz was ordered to approach Bandera's two lieutenants and persuade them to relinquish their work for the SIS and join Galen's newly established BND. They were offered twice the pay they were receiving from the British. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be, quote, liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. I should just put in parenthetically, this is rather interesting. We were talking earlier about Nicaragua, and it appears that something very similar to this actually did happen among the Contras in Comandante Zero, or Aiden Pastora, as he's known, one of the people, an ex-Sandinista who was resisting the Sandinistas but refused to play the ball game the CIA's way, was almost killed by an explosion at a press conference himself that apparently was set off by his own people on behalf of the CIA, according to later information. So this is not an unusual thing to happen among people who are supposedly fighting on the same side.
Now recall also when a Contra training manual put out by the CIA was brought to light, one of the factors that generated a lot of controversy was the fact that one of the tactics that the Contras, of course, bear in mind their connection with WACL and with all the groups we've been talking about, one of the tactics that the Contra training manual developed by CIA advised was to periodically single out dissident members and make martyrs of them for the cause. Now, one of the things that we're asking here in the course of this investigation is, did that in fact happen to Stefan Bandera, as this Lippholz defector claims?
Start that last paragraph again. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. The Pulak official then offered Lippholz 20,000 marks for killing Bandera. They had several meetings and a plan was prepared to poison him. He took his meals in the canteen at the office of 67 Zeppelinstrasse, and Lippholz was given poison to put into his soup or a drink. The Pulak official gave him a fake passport in the name of Karl Lipnitsky, and told him that immediately after completing the assignment he could go to Austria, where Galen's agents would look after him. Lippholz stated at the press conference that he had not been able to go through with the murder of Bandera, with whom his relations were friendly. Moreover, knowing of several killings amongst the members of rival factions, he was afraid that he might be discovered and become the victim of the vengeance of Bandera's supporters. Using the passport Dr. Weber had given him, he went to Austria and then to Italy. In Austria, he heard from some Ukrainians opposed to Bandera that, quote, the Galen people had hired another would-be assassin, one Dmitry Miskiv. In October 1959, he heard of Bandera's sudden death and realized that he must have been murdered by a hired assassin. He traveled across Europe to Norway and eventually in 1961 decided to go to East Germany and ask for political asylum, although he had never been a communist. He had arrived in East Berlin a few weeks before the Stashinsky case was revealed in Bonn, and had regarded it as his duty to inform the East German authorities of what he knew of Galen's efforts to, quote, liquidate Bandera 2 years earlier. Stashinsky's confession that he was a Soviet agent, quote, was a tissue of lies contrived by the American CIA and Galen. He was a member of UPA and had been hired by Galen to dispose of the undesirable Ukrainian leader. There was not much factual evidence to support these enormous allegations, nor was any better evidence supplied by another ex-Galen agent, Otto Freitag, who had also defected and was exhibited at a second press conference. The publication of their stories was conveniently timed to exonerate the KGB chiefs from the two murders and at the same time to discredit Galen and the CIA. Okay, before I finish, I just want to mention one more thing. Just want to insert something real quickly. Again, now notice, now as far as Cookridge is concerned, that all of this stuff has got to be phony. He uses terms like enormous allegations, not much factual evidence, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Bear in mind, though, that we're talking that in the case of Stashinsky, who claimed to have done it on behalf of the KGB, he just happened to be carrying around a broken key, which just happened to have the other half of that broken key still left in the lock some long period of time after the assassination, the so-called assassination had taken place, which nobody had happened to find in the lock. Nobody had bothered to go to the apartment. Nobody had tried to open the door, apparently, or anything. And this piece of concrete evidence just happened to be sitting there waiting all this time for somebody
almost,
to prove it.
Almost 2 years. Bandera assassinated in October of 59, and here we are in 1961, and the key is still in there.
That's right, and Stashinsky is still carrying the other half of it around with him, even though it's a key that would link him to a capital crime if he was arrested by the police.
And which, if the KGB got him, according to usual intelligence, or at least some intelligence procedures, they might want to get rid of him if that key would have been able to link him and through him them to the killing. That would have been a very good way, if he was really a KGB agent, to sign his own death warrant.
That's right. So Cookridge is not Cookridge is fairly incredulous about the testimony of Lippholz, but he does not seem to be sufficiently credulous. Is sufficiently incredulous about the testimony of Stashinsky.
Adding one detail, of course, we're not holding a brief here for the KGB or the Soviet Union or anything else. Because the Bandera murder figures very prominently in the Kennedy assassination, as we're about to see, we're examining the circumstances in detail and taking note of some of these, frankly, incredible-seeming discrepancies.
Okay, last paragraph here. Felfa probably had a hand in producing the two defectors. Certainly, he was busily supplying the communists with material in order to keep the anti-Galen propaganda campaign going. During those weeks, he exchanged frequent radio signals with Karlshorst, but by then he was under close surveillance. On October 27th, a KGB radio signal to Felfa was intercepted by Galen's monitoring service at Stocking. It read, quote, "Urgently require advice whether unmasking action against Galen should continue."
Okay, now remember, too, that as a result of this, Heinz Felfa, Galen's chief of counterintelligence, who was definitely KGB, was unmasked. Now, one thing to consider is whether, at least in part, the Bandera operation may have been a trap in order to do just that, to trap Heinz Felfa and unmask him as a KGB agent. By the way, he was eventually released from prison and just a couple of weeks ago published his memoirs. Now, keep in mind the Bandera death and some of the discrepancies we spoke about. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stefan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly, to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Reading that last sentence again. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stefan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Okay? Later spokesmen for the American right wing sought to link Stashinsky to Oswald, some even speculating that they had both been trained at the same special Department 13 school for assassins in Moscow. Curiously, none of these spokesmen observed that the date of Bandera's death, October 15th, 1959, was the date Oswald entered Russia. So that it certainly is an intriguing coincidence that the day, of course, recall in Radio Free America number 13, three Americans defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. All three of them repatriated in 1962. One of them was Lee Harvey Oswald, one of Marina's Russian handlers in Dallas, who we're going to look at a little later, when being interviewed by the Warren Commission about why Lee Harvey Oswald went to Russia, gave the cover story for one of the other three Americans who defected. Now, that's an interesting coincidence. Now, bear in mind here that there is an attempt by the American right wing to link Stashinsky to Oswald, And, of course, the Bandera assassination used to build up the importance of the OUN Bandera to the American authorities and to indicate how concerned the Soviets were with him and also to destroy the growing rapprochement between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy. But at least one of these pro-Ukrainian spokesmen, former Representative Charles Kirsten, who had succeeded Edison as a member of the World Anti-Communist Steering Committee alluded to earlier, began to develop the picture of a Soviet assassin conspiracy 2 weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. And quoting here from a letter which Kirsten wrote, 15 days before he was shot down, President Kennedy was warned that assassins were being trained in Russia to commit murders in the U.S. and England. This warning was voiced in a letter former Representative Charles Kirsten, Republican of Wisconsin, sent the late president and his brothers, Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Senator Edward Kennedy. The burden of Kirsten's letter was an effort to obtain administration help in focusing public attention on the assassination of Stefan Bandera, the Ukrainian underground leader by communist agents. In urging this, Kirsten wrote, unquote, "The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee has been contemplating a hearing of the killing in Munich of the Ukrainian underground leader Stefan Bandera by the former Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, whose German trial Kirsten attended as counsel for Mrs. Bandera," interestingly enough. It was a bizarre assassination illustrating the subversive operations of the Soviet police in the free world. Apparently, the State Department is trying to prevent the hearing. Before his defection, Stashinsky was being trained for high-level killings in England and the U.S. There are others in such training, according to his testimony. I have been informed indirectly that the State Department called for a delay of the hearings and may possibly desire their cancellation. Okay, so 2 weeks before Kennedy's assassination, a key wackle person, a key person with the Wackle Steering Committee, who also happened to be the counsel for Mrs. Bandera at Stashinsky's trial, is warning that assassins are being trained in Russia to come kill Americans in America. And, of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, we looked at the extensive attempt to portray Lee Harvey Oswald as a leftist and talk about his connections with the Soviet Union, his travels in the Soviet Union. And we've also looked at the fact that he was almost beyond a doubt a U.S. intelligence agent who was being set up as a patsy. Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. 3 or 4 days after the Kennedy assassination, a Munich right-wing newspaper linked to the ABN, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, was able to publish the hitherto unrevealed story that Oswald shot at General Walker, and added to it the story that Oswald and Ruby together had been released at the insistence of Robert Kennedy. Of course, that's nonsense, and we looked at the setting up of the Oswald shooting at General Walker in Guns of November number 2. We also looked at some more of that connection in Radio Free America number 11. Either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee, of course that's one of the groups that resulted in Wackel, continuing, either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee added to the picture that Oswald was part of a left-wing assassination plot. The press secretary was Salvador Diaz Verson, V-E-R-S-O-N, president of the Liga Anticomunista de Cuba and a former chief of Cuba's military and intelligence service under Prio Socarrás. He helped start an unfounded rumor in Miami that Oswald, while in Mexico City in September of 1963, quote, met the Cuban ambassador in a Mexico City restaurant, and they drove off in the ambassador's car so they could talk privately, unquote. Other Cuban exiles in Miami, in touch with State Department security officers, were at this time spreading rumors about the pro-Castro connections of Jack Ruby, and of course, as we looked at in Guns of November, Oswald as well. And recall also that Carlos Marcello's lawyer became secretary of what was of the Latin American CAL branch, and also Maurice Brooks Gatlin, another key member of the steering committee, hooked up with Oswald at 544 Camp Street.
And of course, the real irony of this lobbying effort on behalf of these people, on behalf of the Cubans, the anti-Castro Cubans, was that all of Oswald's and Ruby's contacts with Cubans were with anti-Castro Cubans, both of which were documented in our Guns of November. And as we shall see later on, the irony of the pro-Ukrainians, anti-communists, that Oswald was some kind of a Soviet dupe, was that all of Oswald's contacts in America with Russians were with white Russian anti-communists, as we will see later in this broadcast.
Okay, continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy. We shall come later to Oswald's apparent link while in New Orleans in 1963 to Americans who were in touch with the Latin American elements of the WACFL steering committee. Maurice Brooks Gatlin, part of a right-wing group at an address used by Oswald for his Fair Play for Cuba committee, unquote, attended a Congress in 1958 of the Inter-American Confederation for the Defense of the Continent, CIADC, along with Salvador Diaz-Verson, Fritz Kramer, Ku Cheng Kang, he's a key Kuomintang developer of WACL here, and Nestor Prochyk, P-R-O-C-Y-K, the chairman of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. All of this suggests a continuity, albeit one that may be more symptomatic than explanatory, underlying the significance of Oswald's contacts with Spaz T. Rakin in June of 1962. Recall Spaz Rakin of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations.
Okay. We're just about to go off into the strange, bizarre, and disturbing world of Dallas's white Russian community and Lee Harvey and Marina Oswald's connections with those self-same folks at the same time that Oswald was being denounced as having been a dupe of the communists and the KGB. And we will be following those tangled and complicated trails when we come back from a short break, which is what we're going to take right now for about 7 or 8 minutes. We have returned. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery in the studios at KFJC, and we are partway into the third hour, yes, we're almost halfway through the third hour of Radio Free America. Time begins to blur after a certain point. And we are, of course, talking about the World Anti-Communist League, and we are going to be wrapping up our coverage of the World Anti-Communist League, at least in archive form tonight. And you will recall, just before the break, we came up to the beginnings of discussing the Kennedy assassination and the involvement of Lee Harvey Oswald. We talked about numerous happenstances in Europe, specifically in Munich, having to do with Stefan Bandera, the death of Stefan Bandera, who was head of the OUN Bandera, elements of which are still alive and kicking today and very much a part of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy making. And the death of Stefan Bandera was blamed on the KGB. Other sources suggest that it was, in fact, a Galen operation job to take a difficult person out of the way and also to make a martyr for the rightist movement. And we saw how, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, indeed many right-wing circles linked to Stefan Bandera and other of the right-wing groups, the American Security Council-type groups, immediately tried to tie it into Stefan Bandera's death and suggest that the man who shot the man who said he killed Bandera on behalf of the KGB was in fact part of a Department 13 hit team, of which Lee Harvey Oswald also was part, Department 13 being the KGB's murder specialty division. So we begin to come to the actual substance of the assassination itself. Of course, we also discussed before that the fact that the Eastern European revanchist organizations that were such an important part of the World Anti-Communist League's American branches were very upset with the Kennedy administration, first of all, for their refusal to support the concept of captive nations of the Ukraine and other parts of Russia as being separate nations, and also with Kennedy himself for his overtures to Khrushchev toward in the directions of nuclear disarmament and nuclear treaty test banning.
Recall that that the day that Bandera was assassinated was also the day on which Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union. And, of course, recall also the Bunker Hunt connection with the CDCC and the American Volunteer Group that he proposed to assassinate people using weapons sounding very similar, a gas gun developed in Germany in conjunction with Walker's John Birch cell and so forth. And again, the attempts on the part of WACL elements to represent the Bandera assassination and to link it with a Soviet plot against the life of President Kennedy. And, of course, we've looked at the efforts to portray Oswald as a leftist in the past.
Okay. Now, again, going back to Peter Dale Scott's monograph on the subject, we're going to look at some of the people surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald. Again, in the Guns of November, we went over rather exhaustively the fact that, despite the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was portraying himself as a pro-Castro leftist, all of his contacts in the Cuban community were with anti-Castro Cubans of the most fanatical sort, and in fact, the address that he gave for his Fair Play for Cuba committee, of which he was the only New Orleans member, was the same address being used by people planning the Bay of Pigs, being used as an anti-communist front for FBI and CIA operations, and housing also anti-Cuban Castro groups. and it's a strange place for Lee Harvey Oswald to use as his base for his supposedly pro-Castro organization, of which he was the only member, and the only thing it managed to ever do was to get him noticed publicly as being pro-Castro. Okay, so anyway, in a similar way, Oswald is portrayed as possibly having been a Soviet assassin trained by the KGB, but in fact, as we will see, all of Lee Harvey Oswald's contact in Dallas with people of Russian extraction, and they were numerous, are with people who were not only themselves anti-communist Russians, but are linked directly into, first of all, the oil industry in Texas, which is extremely right-wing, and the defense and aeronautics industry, which is also, of course, needless to say, extremely right-wing, plus, more importantly, linked directly into intelligence and military circles. Anyway, reading again from Peter Dale Scott's monograph. The case that Oswald was an agent is strengthened by the paradoxical condition of poverty and privilege in which the Oswalds lived after their arrival in Texas. Though he severed all contact with his family after Thanksgiving 1962, and though he seems to have made not one single friend otherwise, Oswald and his wife Marina were now favored with the attentions of a small circle of wealthy Russians and their friends, connected almost exclusively with the politically influential petroleum engineering industry. The Warren Commission's list of 34 persons, quote, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald may have had contact, unquote, many of whom met Oswald for only a single evening, is striking testimony that Oswald's social life was entirely governed by his Russian patrons. Every single person on this list, as well as some others whom the commission did not include, had been met by the Oswalds through these patrons. This includes the alleged liberal, Ruth Payne of the ACLU, who assumed the same babysitting role between mid-April 1963, the time of the General Walker incident, and November 22, 1963, when relations between the Oswald family and the Russian community were temporarily suspended.
Now recall that in Guns of November number 4, we looked at the fact that Ruth Payne's husband, Michael Payne, was a subordinate of General Walter Dornberger, the military commander of Peenemünde, who became director of research and development for Bell Aerospace, and Michael Payne was right underneath him. This, again, this alleged liberal of the ACLU.
Continuing, this Russian community, by no accident, had links with wealth, petroleum, the political machines of both parties, government, and above all, intelligence activities. Take, for example, the two first people whom Oswald contacted, allegedly in his search for someone in Fort Worth who spoke Russian. Of the two, the Russian-born Peter Gregory, a petroleum engineer, was a personal friend of Mike Howard, one of the two Secret Service agents who isolated Marina Oswald in the days after the assassination. We shall see that Howard used Gregory in his interrogation of Marina, and that Gregory abused this responsibility by significantly distorting what Marina said. The second person, Gregory's friend, Mrs. Max Clark, a princess of the Shcherbatsov family, was apparently the first Russian with whom Oswald made telephone contact, yet she was not asked by the commission to testify. The significance of this initial contact was systematically denigrated in the report, and Mrs. Clark's name was even suppressed from the commission's list of 34 possible Oswald contacts. This is hardly surprising. Though commission counsel Wesley Liebler dexterously avoided bringing this fact out, Max Clark, who was on a first-name basis with a Fort Worth FBI agent who interviewed him, was a former security officer for the Convair Division of General Dynamics, and he himself was, according to one witness, quote, in some way connected with the FBI, unquote. And Convair, up to the time of the Kennedy assassination, was being investigated by a Senate committee for possible major scandals surrounding the controversial contract award to build the TFX experimental fighter plane.
Now, a couple of points to be made here. First of all, incidentally, about the essay here, this monograph, The Dallas Conspiracy, it's lavishly footnoted, and it's an extremely scholarly document. We're not reading all of the footnotes to you, but suffice it to say, virtually every sentence has a footnote connected with it or a reference in parentheses. Very important here is Mr. Wesley Liebler. He was the Warren Commission counsel who was assigned by Alan Dulles of the Warren Commission. Recall Alan Dulles of Bay of Pigs, CIA and Galen fame, for Sullivan and Cromwell, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Wesley Liebler was assigned to handle all of the Russian connections to the Kennedy assassination. Okay, now Wesley Liebler, one I forgot in the hurry to get here this evening, forgot one small document. I'll give you the reference, and we'll read it perhaps at the beginning of our next archive show, just so you have it on tape. Another of Peter Dale Scott's monographs about the Kennedy assassination, published the same year as Dallas Conspiracy, or put together, is called Government Documents in the JFK or in the Assassination of President Kennedy. And on pages 39 and 40 of Chapter 3 of that document, indexed, by the way, like the Dallas Conspiracy by Ted Rubenstein, on pages 339 and 340, that is to say, pages 39 and 40 of Chapter 3 of Peter Dale Scott's Government Documents in the JFK Assassination, he points out that Wesley Liebler was a law partner, or a partner at the law firm of Frank Wisner, okay? The same Frank Wisner who headed up the Office of Policy Coordination, Deputy Director of CIA, and for our purposes here, and most importantly, the same Frank Wisner who, as we saw in Radio Free America number 1, sponsored the entrance of Bandera's organization into the country. Wisner actually lobbied, and in fact lied very thoroughly, in order to get the Bandarowski incorporated into U.S. intelligence so that their ongoing guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe could be carried out. Wesley Liebler, a partner at Wisner's law firm, again from pages 39 and 40 of Chapter 3 of Government Documents in the JFK Assassination by Peter Dale Scott.
And if there's ever anything that almost beyond any shadow of a doubt pollutes the sanctity of the Warren Commission, it's the fact that any time you turn over virtually any name or any fact surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald and his career in the United States before and after his trip to Russia, you find these kinds of contacts, people involved directly into intelligence, the FBI, CIA, various right-wing revanchist groups, right and left, and yet the Warren Commission could still come out of the whole thing and write a report in which Lee Harvey Oswald was a, quote, lone nut with communist leanings, which were just symptoms of his confused mental state. Again, every single stone that you turn over in the Kennedy assassination seems to have CIA or Galen organization stamped on it somewhere. Anyway, going along to talk about some of the other influences on the Oswalds in Texas or some of the other contacts. The guiding influence over the Oswalds of Gregory and of three other Russians, all connected with each other and with the petroleum engineering industry, can only be described as analogous to that of intelligence case officers for their subjects. If the Oswalds needed a car to go shopping or to be moved, the Russian families were there to lend a hand. The penniless Marina Oswald is said to have had 100 dresses given to her in this period, a claim wholly overlooked by the commission in its penny-by-penny accounting of the Oswalds' possessions and budget. One of the chief Russian guardians, George Bouhe, was a 60-year-old personal accountant for Lewis McNaughton of the famous oil exploration consulting service DeGolyer and McNaughton, a man with numerous CIA contacts. Bouhe was said actually to have been, quote, rather mad at Marina for taking an apartment at Oak Cliff because it was rather too far for him to drive and help her when she needed help with the baby. Lee Oswald, who worked in this period as a welder, greaser, or handyman, was also driven to parties and otherwise cared for by a member of the Dallas Petroleum Club and World Affairs Council, Count Sergei George de Morenschild, who knew Jackie Kennedy's family and who admitted working for French intelligence during World War II.
And as we looked at in Guns of November number 4, German intelligence was the intelligence service he worked for and was actually arrested by the FBI for suspicion of that.
De Morenschild, a key witness in corroborating Marina's story that Oswald shot at General Walker, also had numerous political and CIA contacts. He was accustomed to do business on a personal basis with such prominent backers of Lyndon Johnson as George Brown of Brown & Root, the firm whose lawyer Charles Francis helped save Johnson's Senate election in 1948, and John Meekham.
Continuing now with the Oswald's Russian contacts in Dallas. Mrs. Katya Ford, who after the assassination took Marina into her house and became her business agent, is of the Oswald's four Russian patrons the only one alleged to be linked to Jack Ruby. At first, the Warren Commission was asking witnesses about Stanley Skotnicki and Katya Skotnicki as two persons in a list supposed to be associates or friends of people that Mr. Ruby knew and associated with closely, unquote. The commission's interest in the Skotnickis vanished rather than quickened when it learned that Katya Skotnicki was in fact Marina's hostess, Mrs. Ford, and that Stanley Skotnicki was Mrs. Ford's first husband, even after Mrs. de Morenschild volunteered the unsolicited information that Skotnicki, quote, was too anxious to make too much money, unquote. Though Katya denied knowing Ruby, she and her husband Declan Ford, an employee of DeGolyer and McNaughton until October 1962, suggested that their friend and neighbor John M. Grizzaffi, G-R-I-Z-Z-A-F-F-I, a friend of Stanley Skotnicki who was always talking about people in politics, unquote, did know Ruby. Whereupon the commission's interest in Grizzaffi, a man whose name was found among Ruby's effects, also vanished. It thus failed to learn whether John Grizzaffi, the friend of Marina's guardian and of Jack Ruby, was the little Johnny Grizzaffi who shot at Herb Noble on a murder contract for mobster Benny the Cowboy Binion back in 1946. Now recall also that Katya Ford was the woman who, when interviewed by the Warren Commission about why, or when asked why Lee Harvey Oswald went to Russia, gave the cover story for one of the other three Americans who defected in 1959 and returned in 1962 in Radio Free America number 11, while indicating that the Kennedy assassination was probably planned even before Kennedy's election, and again as a military coup. Three Americans defected to Russia, and this from Penn Jones, Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. Three Americans defected to Russia in 1959. All three repatriated in 62. Katya Ford, when interviewed by the Warren Commission, attributed Lee Harvey Oswald's motives for going to Russia to the cover story, or what appears to be the cover story, of one of the other three Americans. And recall the day on which Oswald defects is the day, or allegedly defects, is the day on which Stefan Bandera is murdered. Continuing. What the report calls the so-called Russian community in Dallas and Fort Worth was an unusually intense and political one, intense even in its divisions. As the Warren Commission hearings make clear, all but a small bunch of the Russians in the Dallas area have been brought there since 1949 through the good offices of the Tolstoy Foundation, which had screened immigrants carefully to exclude those of left-wing political views. Those Dallas Russians who left Russia during World War II, like Mrs. Ford, were of course less aristocratic than the Old Guard of two decades earlier. The Church of the Old Guard, unquote, the Orthodox Church outside Russia, received CIA subsidies, and the CIA is said to have used it to recruit spies among the white Russian communities in the cities of mainland China. The Tolstoy Foundation, which maintains a European headquarters in Munich, received as much as $400,000 a year subsidy from the American government, i.e. the CIA, for aiding refugees. In 1948, the Tolstoy Foundation helped arrange the defection of Anna Kasenkina, a teacher who leaped from the window of the Russian consulate in New York. Christopher Emmett of the China, Cuban, and Vietnam lobbies played a prominent role in that defection on behalf of a group calling itself Common Cause Incorporated, which also lobbied for Chiang Kai-shek. And I would add that earlier we looked at in the same essay that Emmett was a key designer of WACL. The other American to do so, that is to aid Anna Kasenkina, was Isaac Don Levine, editor of the China Lobby Review Plain Talk and later a member of the American Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia. Levine was the ghostwriter for Anna Kasenkina's autobiography, Leap to Freedom. His radical rewriting of an article by Emanuel Larson in Plain Talk, Larson later disowned the piece, saying he could hardly recognize it, was also the basis for Robert Morris's attack on the State Department communist conspiracy in the Amerasia hearings. Of course, Robert Morris, we looked at not only someone who was affiliated with WACL, but someone who was a key member of the Aryan Nations complex that we spoke about and involved in the Kennedy assassination, that from Radio Free America number 11. In January 1964, through the good offices of the Declan Fords, Levine met Marina Oswald about writing a book similar to Kasenkina's. In an executive session of the Warren Commission, Mr. McCloy, that's John J. McCloy, who we looked at, by the way, as former U.S. High Commissioner to Germany, who returned many Nazis not only to power in Germany, but also into our own intelligence system, again in Radio Free America number 2. Going back and beginning that sentence again. In an executive session of the Warren Commission, Mr. McCloy told his colleagues that the Levine book would try to tie the Oswald story into the Russian business with the thought and background of a Russian connection and conspiracy concept, unquote. For Isaac Don Levine, the Russian conspiracy concept would have been old hat. We're going to take a look at Isaac Don Levine, who was attempting, again, along with many of the other WACL people, the ABN people, the American right, to portray the assassination of Kennedy as a Russian plot. Keep in mind the fact that he ghost wrote a book for Anna Kasenkina, whose defection he aided, and was going to write a book about Marina Oswald, because we're going to take a look at this man, Isaac Don Levine, last name L-E-V-I-N-E, a pivotal figure in the American far right, and a fellow who's ghostwritten and assisted in some books before.